The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Thank you. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And there's a lot to get to in tonight's show. And just there are so many things happening around the world, so many things which I haven't actually addressed in quite a long time on this show. That have been building up and building up and building up and basically just have to be mentioned here tonight. And so many significant happenings just took place in the last week alone that really merit discussion. And so tonight I want to cover a few things. I want to cover some elections which were very, very significant, which happened recently. I want to talk specifically about Haiti, and I want to talk specifically about Venezuela. I also want to talk about some of the events going on recently in Syria, which are very, very significant in terms of resisting American imperialism, Western imperialism in that part of the world. And I also want to talk about the climate change conference going on in Paris a little more. Obviously, I addressed that a little bit last week, but there's definitely still more to talk about. And I really want to begin, I'm going to begin with the climate change conference, because that is, I know it's on a lot of people's minds now. And one of the things I did talk about last week was how sustainability of any kind is incompatible with capitalism. The capitalist system based on, you know, limitless accumulation and the profit motive, which needs constant expansion if it is not to die. Capitalism really is a cancerous system. You know, it requires continuous expansion. It cannot slow down. It cannot stop. Because fundamentally, it is not based on human need. It's based on the ever-increasing demand of the capitalist class, the class that lives off of profits, like lives off exploiting other people's labor. This tiny minority of people in the world that live off the exploitation of other human beings. As long as profits are in command, as long as those people are in control, you know, we should not expect the issue of climate change to be solved. Ultimately, it can only really be solved when people's needs come first, when people actually have control over their own economies, their own politics, their own lives. And really only socialism can secure that. So I actually just want to briefly go back to, because there's been a lot of fanfare of this last week about things that, you know, that the Justin Trudeau and the Environment Minister McKenna have said or not said, the Canadian delegation and whatnot. A lot of promises have been made. A lot of rhetoric has been said. A lot of things have been spoken. I just want to hearken you back to some of the things the Communist Party actually said on the campaign trail this past October concerning global environmental justice and the need to halt climate change. These are some of the proposals we talked about. I raised this multiple times in the election campaign, as you know, of course, I was running here in Guelph. And I'm going to quote directly from our election pamphlet. And this is what we proposed when it comes to policy dealing with climate change. Emergency legislation slashing greenhouse gas emissions and climate reparations for affected countries. No to expanded pipelines and fossil fuel exports. Phase out the tar sands, guarantee jobs at equivalent wages for all laid off workers. Invest heavily to create jobs by expanding renewable energy and conservation programs. Substantially expand urban mass transit, eliminate bus and transit fares, fund high-speed rail. Impose heavy fines and jail terms against polluters and destructive corporate practices. Now, how many of these things have been put in place by the new government? The answer is zero. There has been no emergency legislation slashing greenhouse gases. There's been a lot of happy talk, but there's been no concrete action whatsoever. The pipeline network and the fossil fuel exports have been allowed to expand. Indeed, there's been agreements on tar sands expansion between mainstream environmental groups and the Alberta government recently. There have been no phase out of the tar sands, but workers have still been losing their jobs. In fact, an article in the Globe and Mail just pointed out very recently the suicide rate in Alberta has jumped by at least 30% over the past year. The main reason for that is because so many people in the energy sector have been laid off due to falling oil prices. You know, and they are basically at the mercy of market forces, and those workers have lost their jobs. They don't have a livelihood. That leads to increase in suicide. There has been no heavy investment to create jobs by expanding renewable energy and conservation programs. That hasn't happened. We haven't seen any move to address urban mass transit. And we've seen no action against, punitive action against the fossil fuel companies and those who are destroying the environment in the name of profit. So basically, we've seen no movement on any of these things, substantial movement by the Trudeau government whatsoever. And there's many things he could have done by this point, but he has not done that. Because ultimately, as we said on the campaign trail, the Liberal government is a party of big business. It's a party of capital. And ultimately, it will defend those interests. It will say a lot of things. It will say many, many things about greenhouse gas emissions and environmental responsibility and, like, you know, Canada is back and all this this kind of happy talk you've heard Justin Trudeau, this hot air that he's been spouting at the in Paris. But we won't see concrete practices. You know, we won't see concrete action. Because ultimately, this government is not willing to challenge the elephant in the room, which is the capitalist system. It is the profit motive. That has to be challenged. That's the heart of the matter. And ultimately, the only way we're going to get action on climate change and the environment is if we have a system of socialism, economic planning, you know, public ownership of the means of production and of energy sources, and actual working people having control, having democratic control over the economy. And only socialism allows that. Capitalism does not allow that. And it's very important to understand. So to illustrate these kind of points further, I want to play a report by Dimitri Lascaris of the Real News Network. He's been in Paris. He's been covering events, and this is his latest contribution. You know, one of his latest contributions to the Real News Network. And this is what he was talking about. And I'm going to play another interview which he did after this with some of the people with an activist he met in Paris, really about some of these issues, but which I've been talking about. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Pires, coming to you from Baltimore. Tuesday was the eighth day of the international climate talks in Paris. COP21, said to be the most important negotiations in the UN's 20 years of conferencing on climate change, or as Desmond Tutu puts it, humanity's last chance salon. As world leaders, government lawyers, and negotiators try to hash out a deal for limiting global greenhouse gas emissions to 2 degrees, we have our own lawyer on the ground, correspondent Dimitri Lascaris. He's on the ground reporting on events thus far. I'm sure you've seen a number of his reports, but today he's going to be talking about the draft agreement. And as you know, Dimitri is normally, when he's not reporting for us from Paris, he's a Canadian lawyer with the law firm Siskinds and a board member of the Real News Network. So, Dimitri, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Charmini.
So, Dimitri, I understand on the train today you actually got a chance to read the draft agreement. Give us a sense of what it's all about.
Right. So just to be clear, what the agreement that the most recent version was issued this past weekend in anticipation of the arrival of environment ministers and other high-level government officials for the high-level talks, which began on Monday. And the agreement that was put to them, the draft agreement, was intended to narrow the issues to a manageable set of issues for the high-level government officials to resolve within the time remaining at COP21, which is to close, you know, it may get extended slightly, but it's supposed to terminate on the 11th of December. So in a few days' time. My understanding is, you know, I spoke to some people at the media center today, COP officials, and my understanding is that tomorrow, something that is apparently being characterized as a final agreement is supposed to be presented to leaders. It's not clear to me at this stage, based on what I've been told, whether that is actually going to be issued to the public, but, you know, that should be close to final, if not final, and should resolve a host of issues. So what I'm going to talk to you about was the agreement that was issued over the weekend. And there have been some developments public, although a new draft of the agreement has been issued, there have been developments that have come to light in relation to this draft. And I'll get back to that later. So this draft, you know, everybody knew, it's been widely reported that it contained significant bracketed language. And the brackets signify that there is not agreement with respect to the issue that is bracketed. So we all understood that. That had been widely known. But when I went into the agreement, what I saw was, it kind of took me aback. In footnote one, it says at the very end that even if the language isn't bracketed, it doesn't necessarily mean that the language has been agreed upon. So basically, there's no assurance that any part of that agreement has been agreed upon. And the language that is bracketed is extremely extensive. And there's, you know, over and over again, you go through the agreement and you'll see that there are a wide range of options given with respect to various issues. And, you know, those options generally range from a reasonably good outcome to a completely unsatisfactory outcome. And so what you have is really a high level of uncertainty with respect to the language going into the high-level meetings, which as I say, commenced on Monday.
Sounds like multiple choice options.
Absolutely. And they're not simple to, you know, to grasp. You have to actually read them very carefully. And there is some important things going on in that language, in those various options, multiple choices that the parties are being given to consider. At the beginning of the agreement, and I mean, they don't even agree on the purposes of the agreement. At the beginning of the agreement, there are two sets of language with respect to the temperature limit. One is keeping temperature limit below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And the other language, the other option they have in their, had in there currently, or at least on the weekend, was keeping it well below 2 degrees Celsius, whatever that means. It certainly doesn't mean over 2 degrees Celsius, but what well below two degrees Celsius means is unclear. Now, we've learned that we knew, and we talked about this in a previous interview, that Germany and France had guardedly embraced the 1.5 degree limit. And I'm not going to repeat what I said there, but the language that they used was constrained. It wasn't really a full-blown endorsement of the idea that there should be a legally binding cap of 1.5 degrees Celsius. And we learned subsequently that the new environment minister for Canada, upon her arrival for Paris on Sunday night, announced to what one reporter described as a shocked conference that Canada was now embracing the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. And many people within the environmental community and the media rejoiced at this. But then, you know, when the Environment Minister of Canada was asked to confirm that this is what she had said in negotiations on Sunday evening, her office issued a statement to the following effect, quote, "The Environment Minister supports including reference in the Paris Agreement to the recognition of the need to striving to limit global warming to 1.5, as other parties have said." This is clearly, and I'm sure that the Environment Minister of Canada, Catherine McKenna, chose her words very carefully. This is clearly aspirational language. And she goes on to say, so in other words, it's not intended to be a hard cap. That's not apparently the position that Canada is advocating.
Nor anything binding, for that matter.
Correct. And she goes on to say that they want an ambitious agreement that's assigned by the greatest number of countries possible. And then she says, and I'm quoting again, "The most important thing is that each country should be legally required to submit a target and to report on progress on that target on a regular basis." Now, I have two comments about this. First of all, that is not the most important thing. The most important thing is that there be a cap on emissions and there be a cap on the degree to which we will allow the global temperature to increase, and that that cap be enforceable. That's the most important thing by far. She's characterizing verification and transparency as the most important thing. And those are important things, but not nearly as important as a legally binding cap on emissions and the temperature increase. So basically what we're going to have, it appears, if Canada has its way and as the other developed countries have their way, is an agreement which contains non-binding, unenforceable targets, and there will be no consequences for violating those targets, but the parties to the agreement will have the ability to verify that the other parties to the agreement are or are not complying with the targets. And if they determine through this legally binding verification process that they're not complying with the targets, they will be powerless to do anything about it. That's what we're getting out of Paris, it appears. And from the perspective of anybody who understands the science, that is a profoundly unsatisfactory outcome. We are at a point where we actually need an ambitious, legally binding agreement that limits the amount of carbon we can put into the atmosphere and consistently with the science. And that means leaving the vast majority of the fossil fuel reserves that have been developed to date in the ground. And we're just not getting that in Paris.
Dimitri seems to be cased in a whole lot of UNEs, this draft proposal thus far. Are there any groups, you've been speaking to so many organizations on the ground, are there any groups that are putting forth a more comprehensive, binding, simpler solution than what you're reading on in this agreement?
Well, I think that the developing states, and particularly the least developed states and the low-lying island states that are at risk of being swamped by the oceans at 2 degrees Celsius or even a number that's less than 2 degrees Celsius, they have been, I think, aggressively and consistently advocating, not just here, but previously. For years, they've been consistently and aggressively advocating for a 1.5-degree limit, binding emissions targets, and an agreement that is enforceable so that there would be meaningful consequences and a meaningful deterrent for countries that did not comply with a target that would have to be adequate. The problem is that the developing world, the developed world, I should say, just isn't on board. It appears that also other major emitters like China and India are not on board. And the reports are consistently, the Climate Action Network has been consistently awarding the Fossil of the Day Award to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia appears to be on a mission to wreck any meaningful agreement or the possibility of any meaningful agreement. And apparently there's something called an Arab Alliance here. And, the other members of that alliance have sort of, including Egypt, Jordan, have apparently been silent, and they've been allowing Saudi Arabia to act as the wrecking ball. So I'm not at all hopeful that we're going to get an agreement that comes anywhere close to doing what we need to avoid a climate catastrophe. You know, as I walk around COP21, I occasionally run into people who are very much of the same view. The other day, as I was about to interview, the gentleman from Carbon Tracker, Anthony Hobley, I crossed paths with a reporter from Ireland, whom I've seen many times before. And I asked him, how do you feel about what's happening here? And he said, I'm absolutely distressed and devastated and disgusted. And there's a real, feeling amongst people here who understand the science and who are serious and don't have an alternative agenda and are serious about dealing with the problem, that what's unfolding here is not going to be as bad as Copenhagen in 2009, but it's going to be bad. And regrettably, that's the reality. And I very much hope that I'm wrong.
We too hope you're wrong. But we will keep reporting on it, and we look forward to your reports. I understand you have an interview coming up with Pablo Salón. Tell us a little bit about him.
He was a former senior official within the Bolivian government. I understand he's been very active and passionate in the climate movement. And I think he's going to give us a valuable perspective from the developing world about what is unfolding here some insights that I may not have into, where we're going to go from here. One thing I should mention, and I hope to raise this with Pablo, is that it appears that reference to indigenous rights has been removed from the agreement. There is bracketed language in the version that was released over the weekend that recognized or sought to recognize indigenous rights. And the reports are that is now gone. So that's one issue that I hope to discuss with Pablo, and I think he'd be well positioned to speak about that.
Well, Dimitri, we look forward to that report and all the best. We'll
Thank
talk
you.
To you very soon.
Thanks, Sharmini.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
The powers that be. The powers that be. The powers that be. A tough game, no rules. Some you win, some you lose. Competition good for you. To die, to be free. They're the powers that be. They're like a bomb-proof Cadillac, air-conditioned old tap, backseat gun rack, platinum hubcaps. They pick horses for courses. They're the market forces. They like order, makeup, limelight, power. Shows, rodeo, Star Wars, TV. They're the powers that be. If you see them come, you better run. 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 You better run.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was Roger Waters with The Powers That Be. And we also heard from Dimitri Lascaris with his latest update from the Real News Network on the climate change talks in Paris. And I'm going to play another interview that he did just this past week in Paris. And in this case, it's addressing the issue of governments. Of the capitalist state, you could say, subsidizing fossil fuel companies, you know, subsidizing energy companies that produce fossil fuels, and really are fueling this entire problem of climate change in a very major way, and basically they get billions of dollars every year from governments, you know, particularly in the West, and this is something that really has not been addressed. In the in the discussions thus far in Paris. So it's very interesting where this interview went and what he had to say. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is Dimitri Lascaris reporting from COP21 in Paris for The Real News. I'm here today with Alex Dukas of Oil Change International. Alex is a senior campaigner with a specialization in public finance. He has a Master's of Science from Oxford University in Environmental Change and Management. And thank you for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you. Great to be here, Dimitri.
So I wanted to start by sharing with you an experience I had the other day. I was trying to find a press conference being organized by Carbon Tracker International. I stumbled by accident into a press conference being conducted by five parliamentarians from sub-Saharan Africa. The tone of that press conference was dramatically different and much more urgent and dire than what we were hearing coming out of Western leaders and business leaders. And one of the first observations made by the panelists was that climate finance was, at COP21, the elephant in the room. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, what do you think he meant by that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that assessment. I mean, this deal is really predicated on trying to bring more players into climate action. It's predicated on getting some developing countries as well as developed countries to take action on climate change, even though the rich countries are the ones that are historically the most responsible and the biggest emitters as well as the wealthiest countries. And so part of the conversation has to be, what can these rich countries do to help poorer countries both adapt to the impacts of climate change and transition away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy? And a big part of that conversation has to be finance. There has to be money on the table. And we're not hearing a lot about how that's going to be delivered, both toward this $100 billion per year target that was pledged by rich countries in 2009, but also post-2020. After that time frame, there's been very little discussion about what money is going to be on the table to help these poorest countries deal with the consequences of climate change.
Are you able to quantify now where we are in terms of the money that is on the table from the rich countries and how that compares to that commitment, that $100 billion annual commitment that you mentioned?
Well, unfortunately, because the rich countries aren't very transparent about where their money is flowing and through what channels and what kind of money it is, they've resorted to fairly dodgy accounting practices. So they have their own figure, but it's heavily disputed by a lot of the poorer countries who are around the negotiating table. So they've said that they're, you know, well on their way toward $100 billion. They're above $60 billion a year in climate finance for poor countries. But it's you know, they're counting the full value of loans, which they're going to get back. They're counting the full value of export credits, and that's money that is supporting their own industries. So they're exporting their own products abroad instead of building industries in these countries to help them develop economically. And it's kind of perpetuating the same economic inequality we see across countries all over the world. And I think, you know, the thing that's frustrating for me is that we know where we can find a lot of this money, because rich countries are throwing hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies at the fossil fuel industry each year.
I want to come back to that in a second, but I just want to flesh out with you what you mean by dodgy accounting. You mentioned loans, for example. At the time they made this commitment of $100 billion annually, was that understood clearly to be outright grants, or was that ambiguous at the time? Was it possibly not understood that some portion of that was going to be in the form of loans?
No, it was a range of instruments and from a range of sources. So loans, grants, public and private. But I think what we're seeing now is that because that was so ill-defined at the time, rich countries are definitely trying to take advantage of that. And, you know, we're seeing that $60-plus billion per year that I mentioned that the rich countries are self-reporting in finance, only a couple billion dollars are in grant-based finance for adaptation. And so adapting to the impacts of climate change is really important. It's very hard to get the private sector to help with that. So that's where a lot of public money needs to be, and that's not where it's going.
Okay. And going back to the question of fossil fuel subsidies, you mentioned at a Climate Action Network conference a couple of days ago, which I had the pleasure of attending, that President François Hollande had asked the question at the outset of COP21, how can we price carbon and subsidize fossil fuels at the same time? And indeed, as you discussed at that press conference and explained more fully in an infographic that Oil Change International subsequently released, fossil fuel subsidies are vastly in excess, those being paid by rich countries in particular, to their contributions to the climate green fund. Can you explain a little bit more in detail about what that disparity is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Green Climate Fund is a really important channel for that money that we were just talking about, from rich countries, primarily from rich countries, to help poorer countries adapt to the impacts of climate change and also transition to clean energy. Their total contributions stand at about $10.2 billion right now. For the Green Climate Fund,
yes.
The total contributions, and from those richest countries, which is the G7 plus Australia, that we looked at in our infographic, their contributions for the Green Climate Fund were pretty meager compared to their subsidies to oil, gas, and coal industries. So what we found was that when we take the G7 and Australia together and we look at the ratio of the money that they're handing over to big oil, big gas, and big coal, it's actually 40 times greater each year than their annual pledge amount to the Green Climate Fund, which is a pretty staggering and stark statistic.
Right. And Canada in particular, where does it stand in that regard?
Canada's not doing well on that front. So it was good to see a pledge to the Green Climate Fund from Canada. It's good to see a promise of $2.65 billion Canadian that's been announced over 5 years by the new government, by the Trudeau government. It's not clear how much of that may flow to the Green Climate Fund. And there's a pledge from the Trudeau government to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies to fossil fuel industry, but we've yet to see action on that pledge. And if subsidy levels remain at the same level that they are in Canada, those that are under federal control, so the one that ones that the Trudeau government can immediately do something about, over that year, 5 year pledge term, we'll see $2.65 billion that they've committed in finance to support poorer countries to deal with climate change, and we'll see more than eight times more in subsidies to the oil, gas, and coal industry in Canada. So obviously more needs to be done.
And James Hansen recently did an article in which he showed the per capita emissions of various countries since the beginning of the industrial era. And the top four countries were the United Kingdom, the United States, Germany, and Canada. And when one takes into account the historical per capita emissions of Canada, what should its contribution, its annual contribution to the Green Climate Fund be, in your view?
When we look at those types of metrics, we would expect total climate finance from Canada toward this $100 billion target, which doesn't deal with the scale of the need, but it's what was agreed pre-2020, back in 2009. Toward that $100 billion, we expect Canada to be contributing at least $4 billion a year by 2020. And in the current pledge that the Trudeau government announced before coming to Paris, it's only $800 million a year, so less than one-fourth of what they promised. And they haven't clarified how they're going to get to that $4 billion figure. And we need to see clarity on that for sure, because as you said, you know, parliamentarians from sub-Saharan Africa are saying we're being affected now by climate change. And how can they ink a deal without knowing that they're going to get the support that they need to take action on climate and to protect their people from the impacts that they're already feeling?
In light of the disparity between the actual contribution that's been promised, the $2.65 billion, and the $4 billion a year, do you think it's fair for the new Prime Minister to characterize Canada as being back on the question of climate change?
I think we need to be, you know, pretty guarded about that assessment. Is Canada back? Rhetorically, yeah, absolutely. They're saying the right things. Are they doing the right things? They're making some good first steps, but we're not there yet. So we really need to watch this next week. Well, we really need to see if we're going to get more than just a lot of talk from the Trudeau government. The tone has certainly changed, but changing the tone isn't enough. We need to see money on the table. We need to see real action. And we need to see that the Trudeau government understands what Canada's fair share is. They've said they're going to approach this in a science-based way. So let's have that conversation.
And why do you think it is that historically we've had so much difficulty liberating ourselves from the fossil fuels industry? And for example, with respect to the question of subsidies, one would think that that's a no-brainer. We're using massive amounts of public money to finance what has generally been a highly profitable industry that is wrecking the planet, to be perfectly blunt about it. You know, one would think that it shouldn't be a difficult sell to the political class to bring an end to that.
Right. And, you know, I sit in Washington, D.C., where probably, you know, almost more than anywhere in the world, there's incredible capture of the political system by fossil fuel money and fossil fuel interests. So major campaign contributions, dirty energy money flowing to senators, people in the House of Representatives, governors, and filling their coffers. And I'll tell you that the oil, gas, and coal industries get a pretty good return on that investment, unfortunately, in the form of these subsidies and these handouts that amount to corporate welfare. And it's really disgraceful that when we're at a big global negotiation talking about a new climate deal that's going to supposedly help us address the problem of climate change, which is incredibly urgent, fossil fuels, that those words don't even appear in the text of the draft agreement. Mm-hmm. We need to name the villains. We need to know who's causing the problem, and we need to stop funding them. I mean, it's, as you say, it's almost absurd to think that we're still handing out literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the industries that are causing the problem and that are trying to deny the science of climate change and block progress.
In Canada, however, the role of corporate money and private money in the electoral process isn't quite as extreme as it is in the United States after the United States Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, which basically removed all restraints on corporate money in the electoral process. Yet we too seem in Canada to almost to have this inviolable bond to the fossil fuels industry, continuing to subsidize them. As yet, we haven't seen action on the electoral promise of Justin Trudeau. Hopefully we will. Why do you think that's the case in Canada?
Well, I think there's always this sort of political entanglement wherever an economy is significantly dependent on fossil fuel production. And that's certainly still the case in Canada, not perhaps to the same degree as in the United States. But when we talk about political capture, regulatory capture, we saw what happened to the National Energy Board under Prime Minister Harper. Hopefully those changes will be reversed and they'll actually have power to meaningfully regulate and monitor the oil, gas, and coal industry. We saw, with this new government, a change in tone again, but actions speak louder than words. And the new Natural Resources Minister has just appointed a chief of staff who is a former vice president of the Canadian Alliance of Petroleum Producers. And I think that is something we need to really keep a close eye on and be vigilant about, because, again, the tone has changed. But that's the kind of action that is not really going to inspire confidence in Canadians.
Right. And finally, in light of what you've seen thus far at COP21, and looking at the landscape realistically, where do you think we're going to end up a week from now when the conference comes to a close in terms of a climate deal?
I think we're hearing some good things from people around the table that are negotiating this deal. They're more willing to talk about a 1.5 degree target, which is something that would help ensure low-lying island states aren't going to go underwater. They're more willing to talk about that kind of a strong target more than they ever have been before. But whatever we get out of this deal is not going to be enough. It's not going to take us past the finish line. The commitments that are on the table from governments on what they're going to do to deal with climate change are going to blow past even a 2-degree limit. We have governments saying one thing, and it looks like they're going to do another, which means that we're going to have to rely on people power. We're going to have to rely on the types of winds that we've seen recently with the Keystone XL pipeline, kicking shell out of the Arctic, and people fighting fracking all over the world. I think people are going to need to step up. We're going to need people in the streets, and that's going to have to be our answer if we have any hope of dealing with this crisis. So.
All right. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work at COP21.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And this is Dimitri Lascaris for The Real News.
I don't want a town. And the gray metal ships call home. And if we think about it, and if we talk about it, and if the seagulls body back, can you tell me what you'll do about it?
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Midnight Oil with Put Down That Weapon. And we had Dimitri Lascaris talking about how public money continues to be thrown basically at fossil fuel companies. They continue to be subsidized by the capitalist state, their profits basically being guaranteed by the state. And how destructive that is and undermining of any meaningful approach on climate change. Now, I want to move on now. There's a lot to get to here on this show. And I wanted to talk about the recent elections in two places. That is in Haiti and in Venezuela. Now, Venezuela has actually gotten some media attention, largely because in a very tragic turn of events, the opposition has gained control. The U.S.-backed opposition in Venezuela set on overthrowing the Bolivarian Revolution and the various gains that have been won by the people and popular movements in Venezuela over the last more than 15 years, that opposition has won the recent elections there, you know, and swept power, controlling the legislative assembly, and how that's been getting a lot of fanfare. Obviously, there are right-wing backers in the United States who also backed coup attempts in Venezuela and sabotage of the Venezuelan economy and stuff. Like, they're thrilled. They're absolutely thrilled that they have won. And in many cases, this has been facilitated. This takeover has been facilitated by economic sabotage, basically by the capitalist class in Venezuela, deliberately hoarding products, deliberately creating scarcities and shortages of goods, and facilitating black marketeering the smuggling of goods in and out of the country, and just deliberately trying to undermine the economic policies of the government. And of course, using the drop in oil prices also to their advantage in doing so, because that means that less and less money is going to be going to the government through oil. So, and the government is going to have less to spend on social programs and the various programs that it has to empower the Venezuelan people. So they've used that to their advantage. They've deliberately fomented public discontent in Venezuela. And that has led to this very tragic outcome. And of course, it's not game over. Nicolas Maduro of the United Socialist Party still is in power, the PSUV. He's still in power. He still holds office. The Bolivarian Revolution still controls the state apparatus and the army. It still has popular militias in the countryside and still has its social movements that really have allowed it to win and hold on to power all these years. But at the same time, it faces a major threat through this. And I hope that what it comes out of this is a renewal of class struggle in Venezuela, taking it to a new level, and the PSUV realizing that it cannot win through reforms and simple having majorities in government. It actually has to ramp up the class struggle and actually take on the oligarchs, take on the capitalist class, who have been sabotaging the economy and fomenting coups and street violence and all this stuff all this year and trying to destabilize the country. That it has to take. It has to empower working class people in Venezuela to take control over their own lives, their own communities, their own workplaces, and do that in a systemic way and really deal the death blow to the capitalist class in Venezuela, because there cannot be coexistence. That's very, very clear from the history going back basically since this entire process of of radical change began in Venezuela in 1998 with the election of Hugo Chavez. It's very, very clear that the right wing, the reactionary forces and the class forces that they support in Venezuela will not tolerate any challenge to their power. And they will continually work to usurp and undermine any government that attempts to bring about change that actually empowers the Venezuelan people and tries to extend democracy and put power into the people's hands. It will work against that. It will try to sabotage that at every turn. The only way to really make the changes, with regard to healthcare or food security or jobs or access to education or access to all the different things which have been won, and it's impressive the kind of changes that have been that have been made over the last 15 years in Venezuela, poverty elimination programs that have just drop the level of poverty in Venezuela to, into the single digits, where it used to be almost 50% of the population lived in poverty in the 90s. Incredible changes have been made. Illiteracy has basically been eliminated. People have access to healthcare. They have access to public education. They have access to all these things they didn't have access to before. Housing, public housing has been a major priority, and people actually have decent homes to live in now. And all this kind of stuff has been won. And this is what the opposition, which has just won that recent election, once again, through deliberate created conditions of economic discontent, creating a crisis and undermining the government through deliberate sabotage, it has managed to manipulate things so it won. All those gains are now under threat. And of course, by this necessitates a ramping up of the class struggle. Of the people defending the gains that they have been won, and not allowing this U.S.-backed right-wing takeover to emerge victorious, not allow it to claw back those gains that the working class people have won, and in Venezuela, there's a lot of struggle that's going to be ahead from this, but the election, which has gotten virtually no attention. An election which has taken place in a colonized country, an outright colonized country. That's the election in Haiti, which happened very recently and which is still contested. There's major allegations of corruption in that election, and it's still causing unrest in that country. And I'm just going to repeat here what Justin Poder, who wrote an amazing book called about the coup, the Western-backed coup, which toppled the popular government of Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide in 2004. He wrote this piece just after the Haitian elections, just this past month. And he wrote, for the past 11 years, since the coup and overthrow of the elected government in 2004, Haiti has been deemed so dysfunctional, so failed a state, that the international community has decided to run it directly. UN troops patrol its streets, non-governmental organizations oversee most aspects of social provision, donors provide the finances, the resources and reach of the government is limited. There were elections in 2010 and 2011, and there will be a runoff presidential election at the end of December 2015. Both of these took place under this limited government, maximum international community regime, which could be called donor rule, and which I have called Haiti's new dictatorship. The 2010-2011 elections were politicized and unfair. They banned the most popular party. They banned the most popular party, Famille Lavalas, from running. The first round of the current elections have been characterized by massive fraud, and Haitians know it. They have no confidence in the elections. They are protesting, and their protests are met with tear gas from police, one of the few things that the government is allowed to do, though this important duty is often shared with the UN. Some observers may throw up their hands and say, how could you expect credible elections? Haiti is a poor, dysfunctional country. But Haiti has had fair elections. They occurred in 1995 and in 2000, before the UN took over. The international community, which has been governing Haiti directly since 2004, is the body that is incapable of running a fair election. As in Haiti, so in Afghanistan, where the 2014 presidential elections were run by Ashraf Ghani, after which the international community imposed a power-sharing agreement with the loser, Abdallah Abdallah. An extraordinary agreement was brokered as part of this, and the exact vote count, that the exact vote totals would not be made public. Right? See, this is what happens in a country, in countries which do not have self-determination, which are basically ruled as colonies, which is the case with Haiti and Afghanistan. They do not have self-determination in these countries. You know, the will of imperial powers is imposed upon them. Just like the United States has been trying to impose its will on Venezuela. You know, and they, of course, every election that happens there, it's predictable. Even in this election, they always cry foul. They always say that there's corruption going on, that the Venezuelan government is engaging in corruption and rigging the elections. No evidence of that has ever emerged. Every time like a independent organization goes in there and monitors the election, it says it's clean. It's one of the cleanest elections they've ever seen. And basically those allegations of corruption are weapons that the United States uses to slander Venezuela and try to delegitimize the Venezuelan government and the entire Bolivarian Revolution and all the radical changes that have been going on there. And, you know, of course, it uses the same almost white man's burdens kind of argument with Haiti, you know, basically saying, oh, the Haitians are not fit to govern themselves. You know, they need, you know, this powerful organization, this